It's a greenhouse real six.
As we pass through Villa Nuevo de la Cañada, I'm in the back of the truck. In the front is the driver and the French comrade who did the French edition of my fight, our fight. The truck got itself caught in between the overhanging section of two buildings. So I went to the back of the truck and decided to put my hands on the wall and pull the tilt, which is a steel frame, pull it away so that we could get through. And as I did so, I thought I'd been hit by bullets. What I'd done is to put my hands in the hornet's nest and I've stunned all over my hands. But, I mean, it wasn't so bad as the, you know, I mean, it didn't mean other than I was badly stunned and Doxon put me right there by putting some stuff on. And we finished up driving the truck onto a dry riverbed. And this was where the 15th Brigade would have its headquarters. There was my truck, there was a campaign truck, and then further on was other sort of headquarters units being set up. Vic, by this time, had decided that he would go and join the battalion. And so I was the only one left in charge of the truck. They started to shell us, and I dived out of the truck quickly, dived into a ditch, and the shell went dead on top of the truck and demolished it completely. So I then became a sort of runner, just taking messages between here, there and everywhere. The Battle of Brumetti was a really devastating action, because the fascists would send a plane over. Our anti-aircraft would fire, two planes would come over and the anti-aircraft would fire again, and then the anti-aircraft fire would stop. We'd run out of shells. So on long then would come the bombers. The Canadian nut pots were caught in the middle of a field in this way. They were strafed and they were bombed and there was no defence against it. And this sort of happened every day. You could see that we knew that we were short of ammunition. You know, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, because I was watching things, you know. I mean, that was my job. I was there reporting things, and so I was watching things. So this was the problem, you know. Then reports kept coming through that the battalion was out on a limb on a mountainside, had nothing to eat or drink for 2 days, and they were pinned down and couldn't move. And as far as I was concerned, you know, I was simply taking messages around then. And eventually the battalion is pulled out, and we go to rest somewhere about 3 miles behind the line. But before this happened, I'm delivering a message one day to one of the other battalions, and I came across a man from Manchester, a man who'd been in the Labour League of Youth. And he recognised me and said, "What sort of a bloody army do you think this is?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, I've just left a meeting up there," and he said, "There's a British battalion, all the British troops gathered round a truck, and there's a bloke called Topsail telling them to walk out of the line and march up on the headquarters and protest about the fact that they're being sent into their deaths for no reason at all." I said, "You don't mean anything." He said, "It's He said, I'm just leaving. He said, I'm off, you know. He said, I'm not going to stay in a mob like this. I said, when did you come? He said, day before yesterday. Reinforcements. I dashed off and I found George Aitken. Told him what type of guy I'd been. He sent me off to see if I could find out where it was. In the meantime, I ran across a Welshman named Bill Lloyd. He was Jock Cunningham's runner. And I asked Bill where he was going. And he said that he was off to find Jock because he'd also come across Tapsell telling the men to desert and march on headquarters and demand the heads of the generals. So I went, but I just too late. Bill had found Jock. Jock had taken Tapsell and had put him in a vehicle, and the pair of them had gone off with Tapsell under arrest. The upshot was that Chopik and Klaus were demanding Tapsell's head. Aitken told me that he had pleaded that it was politically suicide to take this action against Tapsell because Tapsell was a member of the Central Committee of the Communist Party. And that kind of scandal should not be allowed. He himself would take Tapsell back to England. But they went to Albacete, and from Albacete they must have been in touch with the Communist Party, because eventually Cunningham, Aitken and Tapsell came back to England. In the meantime, Nathan had been killed. The bomb had come over and Nathan had been killed. And the death of Nathan changed the whole concept of what the 15th Brigade should be. Because Nathan, first of all, Cunningham had been promoted from battalion commander to a sort of regimental commander, insofar as he was in charge of three battalions and was to manoeuvre them into the place where in accordance with the battle plan. But Cunningham wasn't that kind of a soldier. You know, he was a good company commander, he was a good battalion commander, but he definitely wasn't a staff man. Bill told me that one day,
Bill who?
Bill Lloyd, his runner, that one day they were in a sort of dugout, the battalion was in front of them, and a truck got itself bogged down under fire. And somebody told Jock Cunningham that there was some beer in that truck. So instead of sending somebody else to see it, he went out one night and he came back with a couple of crates of beer into the dugout where they are, and they're sitting having a drink when a runner from the battalion arrives, and of course the battalion hadn't had any water for 3 days, and there's Jock drinking a glass of beer, so you can just imagine the story he took back, you see. But the point was, the envisaged plan was that the 15th Brigade should become an entirely English-speaking brigade. That Klaus and Chopik should go to somewhere else. That Nathan should be promoted. That the Americans, who had two or three people who'd been through West Point, should be promoted. That Aitken should remain as political commissar, and that the Bartel, who was the French deputy commissar, should be replaced by one of the Americans, and so on. All of this was the general plan. But with the death of Nathan, with Cunningham, before Cunningham went back to England, there was a bit of a party to say goodbye. And Cunningham was presented with a cigarette case on which was engraved a map of Spain. And some wag said, that's to give him his first lesson in map reading. Because there was always flare-ups about where are this, where are these, where are those, you know. And they were trying to fight a battle which was open warfare in those cases, the advance on Las Rosas, on Brunete. I mean, we got within 500-600 yards of Brunete, and then were pushed right back beyond Las Rosas, you know. And mainly because tactical errors, but mainly because we didn't really have the logistical support which would enable us to fight that kind of place, you know. Anyway, we're now pulled out of the line, and my truck is at the bottom of a dry riverbed somewhere, and so I am transferred. The whole command of 15th Brigade reverts to the Americans. And I am transferred to the American political commissariat. And instead of a hand-turned gestetner, we have a staff of about 30 with cartographers and photographers and a printing press and everything. And of course I'm really out of my depth. I didn't like the Americans.
Why not?
Well, the first night back with the Americans, we're in this village, and they have the white helmeted KPs with the long sticks wandering around, just as like the American army does.
Military police?
Yeah. And I had never met this since I'd been in the brigade. And, it struck me as being out of place. The whole atmosphere struck me as being out of place. You know, being a bit cynical, the slogan of the American Communist Party in those days was, communism is 20th century Americanism. And,
you mean they were nationalistic?
As far as I was concerned, being an internationalist, that struck me, that's why it struck me, so I didn't like them. And, and this was the sort of attitude which I found, and so I went back to the battalion.
You asked for a transfer?
Well, I mean, they just said, you're not doing anything, you can't do anything here, so, go back. This was talking things over with Frank Ryan, because Frank was still around, you see, and I'd been doing quite a lot of work for Frank, carrying things to Madrid when we'd been in Morata. He was, as I say, doing this book, and he was taking pages of it to Madrid to have it typeset and so on. Eventually, it was produced and printed in Spain, was this book, you see. Because Frank never came home, you know. And so we were very good friends, Frank and I. And so I went back to the battalion. Now, we moved away from this whole area and went into the... into a town near the Ebro, because we were preparing for the first Ebro battle.
When? Which month is this?
So this would be August, September 37. Yes, I think it would be August, September 37, just before, around the Ebro battle. I'm a bit hazy about dates, because... I'd had quite a shock, of the Brunetti battle and the blowing up of the truck and the finding Tapsell doing what he had done, and so on. Probably I was becoming a bit demoralised.
Just before we go on to the Ebro, can you understand what Tapsell said? Or the rumours of what Tapsell said?
Well, the point was that he was true, but that was the role that we were supposed to play. That was the role that the British Battalion played in Arama, and in Arama it saved Madrid.
In a kind of shock role.
We were, in fact, guinea pigs being sent up to the front. This is true. You know, we had to give an example, because don't forget that they were trying to rebuild an army. They were trying to get completely untrained men made into an army. All the Spaniards who were coming to join us were sort of almost semi-conscripts, as it were, and they would arrive with their suitcases and their lunch bags and everything else, and their rifles strung across the shoulder, and not knowing anything at all. They probably had 3 or 4 weeks training. So any sort of feeling on our part that we were in the wrong place would have translated to them.
You mean you had to set an example?
We had to set an example. There was no question about that. Whatever we did had to, you know, there was no question of being the kind of thing that the Tatsu thought we ought to be. In other words, treated as an elite troop. Who were not put into battle, not sent into the awkward places in battle.
So you didn't have any sympathy with them?
Everybody was an elite troop, and everybody had to take the place in the front line of the battle, you know, it didn't matter who they were. And it's true that that things were bad, but the things were bad mainly because we had not sufficient experienced soldiers to hold things together. All our soldiers were amateurs. Once before I'd been asked about this, the difference between the British and the other units, which I knew, you know, the French and the Dombrovskis and so on. And there were no... Nathan was the only professional British soldier who joined the International Brigade. Everybody else was an amateur. We may have been, you know, like Jock Cunningham may have been a sergeant, but that's not the same. A British Army sergeant is not a professional soldier. He is simply there to carry out orders and so on. Whereas the Continentals, they'd had conscription, they'd had fascism, and therefore they had officers from their army who had become anti-fascist because of their nationalism. And as a consequence, I mean, most of those officers actually had escaped from their own country and gone into Russia as political refugees. So and then from there they came to Spain, so Chopich and Klaus and Gal and all these others, you know, they were professional soldiers who knew what they were doing. But we didn't have that. We didn't have it at even at company level.
Sorry, I interrupted you with you about to go to the Ebro.
Well, we went to the Ebro, and I am now part of the battalion. And then we're in training, we'll say. And now by this time, of course, we've got some uniforms, we've got helmets. We've got a rifle that looks like a Lee Enfield rifle and so on. And we're sending men away for some sort of training, as the non-commissioned officers training, sergeants and so on. So they're going off for a 3, 4, 5 week course for training and so on. But I'm at a sort of loose end. And then I'm asked to prepare a speech of welcome because Bill Rust had come from England and was joining the brigade. Bill Rust was Manchester. Well, he has Lancashire District Party Secretary, and I knew Bill Rust. And also, the new Ronnie Tatsuma was coming out to become battalion commander. Now, this presented me with a very serious problem. No way could I say welcome to Ronnie Tatsuma. No way. And at the same time, I couldn't say why I'm not going to say welcome to Ronnie Tatsuma. In fact, you know, I would have just turned my back on him if I'd met him and so on. And I don't want to let anybody know what happened, because by then, most of the battalion were new recruits who knew nothing whatsoever about Brunetti. I mean, we lost some 30 deserters after the Battle of Brunetti because of what Tatsuma did. And so, the only thing I could do was to get drunk on the night of the night when they were having this reception. And I got too drunk to go to it.
You did it deliberately?
Coward.
Yes. But 2 or 3 days later, Frank Ryan said to me, "I've never known you to get drunk before. In fact, I didn't even know you drank." I said, "I don't." He said, "Well, what happened?" I said, "Well, how could I give a speech of welcome to Tatsuma?" I said, "I admired George Aitken, and they've kept him in England." I said, "Jock Cunningham, I can understand them not sending him back, because he'd been promoted way above his head, and they couldn't demote him, so obviously he can't come back." I said, "Well, George did a very good job." "Oh yes, I know that." He said, "But you lost the battle in London." So I said, "Well, there was no way in which I'm going to do anything, you know." "All right," he said, "I'll think about it." Well, then we moved into the Ebro action. And I'm marching up the road, and along comes Frank Ryan, very quickly, spotted me. "I want you," he said. And I said, "What's happened?" He said, "I've got a new job for you." We went back to headquarters, and he came out, and I had been promoted captain. And I was the political commissar for the transport column in Alba City. And
how did you feel about that?
Well, this got me out of a problem, didn't it? I mean, I didn't have to meet Tatsuma. I didn't have to tell anybody why. The point was that Frank said to me that I was going to Alba City, and I was going as political commissar in the autopark. And then he said, "Oh, but you can't go to Alba City as a soldier, as a private." He said, "There are all bloody generals down there." So he said, "Wait a minute." And he dashed in, and he must have written this thing out himself and stamped it. So I was captain.
You're showing me a photograph of yourself. Is this?
That's me.
And have you got some captain's pips?
No, they were red ones, because in the police and the political section, you actually had two red bars
on your shoulder.
The gold bars were military, the red bars were gold. They were political, so I was a political commissar.
On your epaulette?
Yeah, not yet. And so the other commissar, the autopark at Alba City was mixed, British, French, some Italians, and the other political commissar was Italian. So, if he wanted to talk to the English, he spoke to me in Spanish. My Spanish wasn't all that good, but it was adequate, because I'd been learning all this time I'm in the, you know. Then I would tell the drivers what he wanted to do and so on and so forth. And so I had by then it was mainly a case of almost like a padre in the British Army, you know, just to take care of morale, just to make sure that they get their letters home, that they if they've got any problems, you can talk them over and so on and so forth. I used to tell stories or give lectures, you know, about the earlier battles and how, in fact, we were now progressing beyond the stage of the guerrilla fighter, which I had been in December, to the member of an army which was now getting thoroughly organised and becoming really organised by the creation of an army, explaining the problem of the Poom, which they couldn't help but get together, you know, because they knew about the Poom, and from we used to get British newspapers coming up, we used to get quite a lot of British newspapers and British newspaper people. I knew Sefton Delmer, I knew William Forrest of the News Chronicle, Sefton Delmer of the Express, and so on. And so we got the newspapers, and of course all these political things that are attaching to the war. My job was to sort of explain them away as well as I could, you know. And so I became part of this otter park. And then came the Battle of Turnwell. And it was felt that in Turnwell we could take the drivers, take extra drivers, and find a lot of Bute in Turnwell while we were holding it, of fascist trucks. The fascists had been chased out of the town. We could probably get in there and find some trucks and things, you know. But when we got to Turnwell, it was so cold that even the diesel, even our own vehicles wouldn't move, you know. We didn't take them right into Turnwell because they were freezing overnight, and it was the bitterest cold I've ever experienced anywhere. It was really cold. And then we came back to Albacete without any booty. And the local authority in Albacete was organising a victory fete because of the capture of Taylor. And of course all the IB representatives were all to go to this victory fete and so on. In Spain, every town has a paseo. You're like the Ramblers in Barcelona. So somewhere there was a wide sort of concrete road, and on Sunday everybody would pass, the girls with their doma, and the men trying to grab their watches as they passed without the doma seeing them and so on. And this was the place for the fete. There was to be celebration dancing and celebration drinks and celebration this, that, and the other, you know. And